Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show because I'm going to be talking about my best friend's wedding. And to help me do that, please welcome back to the show the co-host of the Book Versus Movie podcast, Margot Donahue. How are you, Margot?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Ready to talk about you women and you stealing the men, fighting over the men. I know how you are.
Oh, absolutely.
I saw this movie.
God.
Oh, goodness. For whatever reason, it honestly just kind of shook out this way. A couple weeks ago, we did Good Will Hunting on the podcast, mm-hmm. and that was from 1997. And then the following week, we ended up doing Chasing Amy, and that was from 1997. And now we're doing My Best Friend's Wedding, and that's from 1997. So I think next week we're going to have to do something to close out 1997 month, which it has unofficially become. But as I was watching My Best Friend's Wedding, I was seeing all these similarities between it and Chasing Amy. And I'm hoping some of them come back into my brain so we can discuss them.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm
intrigued. Men in Black, by the way, is from 1997.
Yes, it is.
And I know that because at the time that this movie came out, I was temping at Sony Entertainment. And cool. Sometimes I got to work in the PR department. And so I remember when they were promoting this movie and the Men in Black. So it's all coming back to me.
That's right. It's only been 20 years. Oh my God. Right.
We're so old.
I know. Anyway, where can everybody find you online?
Well, thank you so much. I co-host the movie Book Versus Movie podcast. My co-host is also named Margot, so it's a little confusing for people, but it's Margot D and Margot P. I'm Margot D, and it's at Book Versus Movie. You just spell that out on social media. And if you're looking for us in iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play, you type in Book VS dot Movie podcast, because Margot and I didn't know what we were doing when we started the show, and we have one RSS feed, and we just have to stick with it. So that's where you can reach us.
And your most recent episode is on The Dead Zone, and I'm assuming that's just coincidence, right? There's no reason why you chose to do The Dead Zone. It has nothing to do with the president holding up a small child to protect.
Oh, it's Greg Stilson all over again.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we picked this months ago, by the way. Dina from Twisted Philly and I did this, but we did it because we were both talking about how we have a weird crush on Christopher Walken, and we think he's really sexy in the movie with that pea coat and the way he walks around that cane. And you want to hear my Christopher Walken impression?
Yes, I do.
Okay, here we go. Ready? The ice is gonna break.
It's like I'm talking to Walken. Well, I have not had a chance to listen to that one yet, but I'm excited to hear it because I like when you guys talk about Stephen King. So,
thank you. And we also just covered Postcards from the Edge for Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
I know. More sadness. Right.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so we're going to be talking about My Best Friend's Wedding a little bit later on. But first, I will ask you, Margot, have you seen anything good lately?
I have seen a couple of things very good. The Magnificent Seven, which I did because you recommended it on your show, and I loved it.
Oh, good.
I really, really loved it. I mean, it's a lot of male energy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a Western. I'm not always great with Westerns, but I thought all the performances were excellent. I thought it was fun. It went at a great pace. I like all the actors in it. I really enjoyed it. It was pretty great.
It's I think it's really entertaining. Although, will you agree with me that it's maybe the most violent PG-13 movie ever made?
I was shocked when you said it was PG-13. Like, as I was watching it, it's astonishing to me. By the way, so is My Best Friend's Wedding.
That's right. Well, that one they get away with just the one F-bomb, right?
When the F-bomb, yeah.
You can
but
do,
anyway,
you can do one, but more than one, then you get the R.
Yeah.
Magnificent Seven is fun.
It's fun. And then the next one I saw was Don't Breathe, because you guys recommended that.
All right.
I loved it.
Oh, good.
And you know, I'm blanking on the name of the lead actor who's the bad guy.
Stephen Lang.
I met him. And
were you temping at Sony at the time?
No, I was not. This was a few years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago, right around Avatar. And I write and I co-produce a podcast called the Fit Bottom Girls Podcast. It's a fitness website and podcast. And he actually was promoting a workout for Reebok at the gym on 57th Street in Manhattan. And we all got to kind of meet him and work out with him. And let me tell you, he keeps it tight. He is in fantastic shape.
Yeah, he's like crazy ripped.
Built. Yeah. He's ripped. Like, he's really slim, but ripped.
Yeah.
And this, the nicest guy, like, his wife was a school teacher for many, many years. They have like grown kids and they've been together for like 40 years and just a sweet, kind, super nice guy. So it was very creepy to watch for this movie. Be a maniac. But he's a great actor.
He's good. Yeah. And you liked the movie.
I loved it.
Good.
I really, really did. Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting into like scary movies now. And then like I'm really into the One Day at a Time remake on Netflix.
I have not watched any of it because I never got into the original One Day at a Time. Like,
it's kind of girly.
Well, I mean, I definitely had it on as a kid, like, because Valerie Bertinelli was on it, but I never really got into it. It was just one of those shows I kind of had an awareness of. So I haven't watched the remake.
It's pretty charming. I mean, Rita Moreno's in there and they have a Schneider. It's Cuban Americans. They kind of update the references, but it's just adorable and sweet and just something like, you know, it's a nice antidote for everything else that's going on in the world. So yeah, that's something I've been into.
Okay, good.
And then I have Hell or High Water is on the deck for this weekend. Have you seen that yet?
I have. Yeah, it's very good.
Okay. I'm psyched to see it.
And another movie that's very much about the world that we live in now. Yay!
Great! Awesome!
Yeah. I only have two quick ones that I'll talk about. One is I just revisited Dead Ringers for the first time.
Oh, God!
In many, many years.
No!
Scream Factory just put it out on Blu-ray, so I hadn't seen it in such a long time. And it was interesting because in my head, this is the movie that like kind of defines David Cronenberg. It's so cold and clinical, but that's not, a lot of his movies are not like that. This is kind of where the switch is. But I ended up liking it even more than I remembered. I was so impressed with Jeremy Irons' performance. And I recognize that there are lots of things in that movie that are nightmarish. I think particularly if you're a woman. Yeah. But yeah, I thought it was really even better than I remember. I would put it pretty high up in his filmography, having revisited it now.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna watch it.
No, it's okay.
I'm one and done with that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember listening to Shockwaves, and Elric Kane was on Shockwaves talking about that movie made him like so terrified of vaginas because he saw the crazy surgical tool and he was like, wait, what? How do you use that? Like, I don't know. It was a funny story. Anyway, last night I watched on HBO just premiered this new documentary called Beware the Slender Man. Have you heard about this?
No, it's on my wish list. So tell me, what is it good?
It's really good. It's about a real case from a couple of years ago where two 12-year-old girls stabbed their best friend like 19 times because they were trying to please this character called the Slender Man, which comes from like a creepy pasta. Just the fact that I have words like Slender Man and creepy pasta bouncing around in my brain makes me resent the millennium. But and so it's like a three-pronged kind of a thing, because on the one hand, I didn't know much about the case. I'd kind of heard that it had happened, and I think that was the first time I'd ever even heard of the Slender Man. So it's about the case. It's kind of a procedural. Here's what happened. Here's, you know, what ended up happening with the girls, and it uses some police interview footage and stuff like that. So that's interesting. Then it's also, there's a bunch of interviews with like the girls' parents. And so it's very much this movie about these parents who feel somehow responsible. Should I have seen something? Should I have noticed that this, you know, trying not to blame themselves, but certainly I'm sure feeling guilty in the eyes of, you know, public opinion. And yeah, so it's heartbreaking in that way, because you can tell that they're just devastated. And then on the third level, it's kind of this movie about internet culture and, you know, we bring these little tablets into our home and they're this window into all these limitless worlds. And you don't know what kids are seeing and how it's affecting them. And so it's like really sad and really kind of unsettling and scary, not scary like in the way that a horror movie is, but like scary, like how am I ever going to live in this world kind of a way. So I thought it was really, really good.
I'm a true crime geek, and I that's been like on my mind. I need to see that one. So yeah, that case really intrigued me. And I just wonder, like, kids that are under the age of 18, you know, their brains haven't even been fully formed yet. So you wonder, are they fixable? Are they treatable? You know, can they get help from this situation? I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's terrifying. And I feel terrible for the parents. I mean, how do you live with that guilt?
Right.
Yeah.
And the state of Wisconsin immediately wanted to try them as adults, which would give them, I think, up to 60 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And so then you're kind of torn, like, oh, but don't they need psychiatric help? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I don't want to say what ends up happening, although I guess it would just be spoilers for real life. But
right.
It's just, it's another one of these cases where you just feel like the system is not working the way that it should.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. But yeah, I really recommend it. I think it's really good.
Okay, I'm going to definitely check that out this weekend, too. I got a lot to go on this weekend.
Yeah, oh yeah. Busy, busy weekend. I feel like it just kind of started showing at festivals, and then all of a sudden, like 2 days later, it was on HBO. But maybe I have that timeline wrong. Maybe it's been around longer than I thought. All right, so let's talk about My Best Friend's Wedding. Because this is a fascinating movie. Last time you were on, we talked about Big. And yeah. Big is this movie that seems like this very kind of populist, mainstream, crowd-pleasing movie. And then as we discovered after an hour of talking about it, like, oh, wait, no, Big's kind of fucked up. And My Best Friend's Wedding, I feel like same kind of a story here.
Yep.
Although I would argue that maybe the ways in which it is fucked up are a little bit more on the surface in My Best Friend's Wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I remember seeing this in 97 and liking it. You know, I like romantic comedies when they're done well, and I enjoyed it. I felt like it was just different enough. PJ Hogan is clearly trying to twist certain conventions of the romantic comedy. I mean, even from the opening credits, I was like, well, I've never seen a romantic comedy open this way. I like that little musical number with Ani DiFranco singing. And
I know, I love that.
Yeah. Although I will. All right. We'll come right back to that. So, and I think the big story at the time that I saw this was that this was like Julia Roberts' comeback movie.
It was a big deal because she had a couple of flops. She'd had that Mary Riley. Remember that movie? Mary Riley.
Yes, I do.
The commercials for that bullshit.
Yes, and
she attempted an accent there. And then she had the Michael Collins one, which bombed. I know. And that's a great story. How they screw that one up, I don't know. But that didn't do well. And she just had a couple of things that just didn't do very well. And she also cut her hair, which is, you know, at the time, people were like, no, you know. She was like, I would say a lot like Tom Hanks, though. Julia Roberts is like a great movie star, and she could pretty much do what she wants. And at that time, she picked any project she wanted to do, she just did it. You know what I mean? And people showed up for it. Now, so it was weird. She had this little patch where she wasn't as successful. So she just went right back into Pretty Woman territory, grew the hair out. You know what I mean? She just looked like healthy and beautiful and smiling everywhere, and just did what, like, you know, shaking her moneymaker, basically. You know, this is what the folks want. This is what they're going to get.
And she did kind of a string of romantic comedies then after this, because we go on to Notting Hill and Runaway Bride, and then she gets serious and makes Erin Brockovich. It's funny because in my memory, like, the Julia Roberts slump is this long period where she was kind of on the outs, because she explodes so much with Pretty Woman. She has Pretty Woman. She has a couple of big hits. And in my memory, I was like, oh, yeah. And then she was kind of on the outs for a really long time. But it's really, we're talking like 3 or 4 years, honestly, because this is 97. I mean, it's not like she was gone for 10 years. And then came back. So I don't, you know, Hollywood's a rough place. But so this brought us back the Julia Roberts that we remembered. And I liked it. I mean, that was pleasant. And then it's been years since I have watched it again. And so revisiting it for this podcast was an interesting experience because.
Absolutely.
I think I was just maybe less forgiving this time. I think when I saw it in 1997, I, like much of America, was willing to let certain things slide because it's Julia Roberts. And I can't stay mad at you, Julia Roberts. And it was almost
Cameron Diaz, right? I think she's adorable.
Cameron Diaz, I mean, we'll come back to Cameron Diaz.
Yeah.
Cameron Diaz is not what's wrong with this movie. Like,
no,
she
is
probably the best character and the best performance in this movie. But I was like, I think the filmmakers were almost counting on the fact that, you know, Julia Roberts will smile and all will be forgiven, because I definitely bought into that. I was like, oh, we can't stay mad at you. And watching it now as more of an adult, I was like, oh, this is a movie about a monster.
Yes. Yes. Well, okay. And my question to you, like, her character, is she based in New York or something? She's not based in Chicago, right?
No, she's not. She is based in New York, yes.
Okay, so she's 28 years old and like a super famous restaurant critic?
Who gives her reviews at the table, which maybe food critics do. But I was surprised when I watched that opening scene. I was like, I'm almost positive they don't say, here's what I'll say in my review.
Yeah, they never do. My friend worked for Bon Appetit magazine. It's a cutthroat business, and it takes you a long time. At that time, this is before blogs and stuff like that. Like, you had to really earn your stripes before you get to do that. And that she's doing it in front of her editor, by the way, like, because he's her editor. It's her boss. They're just like having this meal together, and then she goes, "This is how I'm going to name the review." And they go, "Whew," and they're like, "Oh, she's important, and she's got a cool job."
Right. Because she's got it all together, man.
Oh, she does.
But maybe she doesn't. Because she still smokes and she doesn't have love.
And she falls a lot. She falls all the time. It got so irritating after a while. Like, that would cause a big injury as she falls.
It's so bizarre the way that the filmmakers try to insert comedy into scenes where it's not needed. I mean, the falling is like, well, we haven't had a dumb laugh in a while. Or there's a scene where Cameron Diaz is asking her to be her maid of honor, but it's like, oh, she's driving like a crazy person. So we get to see Julia Roberts be nervous. And the most egregious is when they're in the elevator and Cameron Diaz is giving an insanely heartfelt and kind of mature speech about being jealous of Julia Roberts and having to come to terms with how she feels about that. And the whole time we're just focused on like, ooh, she's claustrophobic. She's getting freaked out in the elevator. I was like, why not just let this play as an honest moment? Why does the focus need to be on Julia Roberts' anxiety as opposed to what's actually being said in this scene?
It's bizarre. And like, can we just say what the premise is?
Oh, sure.
Because this stunned me. This is why I saw this again. And then I sent you a message because like, we have to talk about this shit. Her whole thing is that she and her boyfriend, Dermot Mulroney, who are supposed to be the same age. Really? But because he looks a few years older than her. Not a lot, but come on. But he's supposed to be, they're 27 years old, both of them. They got together at Brown University, like their freshman year, sophomore year, whatever, and then messed around for like a month. And then she said, you know what? I just want to be friends. He's been in a friend zone for 9 years. But they made a pact that if they didn't get married by the time they were 28 to somebody else, they would marry each other. Because if you don't get married by the time you're 28, Patrick,
who is going to want you?
Your genitals will just dry away. You will become a eunuch.
Julia Roberts was about 28 or 29 when they made this, and Dermot Mulroney was like 33.
He's 35.
Oh, he's 35.
Yeah, yeah. And Cameron Diaz was like 25. Oh, by the way, Cameron Diaz is only 20 years old in this movie.
That's a bizarre choice.
Bizarre. And then is she dropping out of college to be with him?
Yes.
She wants to be an architect, and she's going to drop out to follow this jackass who's a sports writer for a newspaper. We know those jobs aren't going to stick around much longer, but she's going to go with him, and they love each other. Okay. But how long do these people know each other? And then they have this whirlwind. What he's inviting her, say, hey, come to Chicago. I'm getting married this weekend. It's like a 4-day extravaganza. it seems like anyway. And so she all of a sudden panics. It's like, oh no, I'm really in love with this guy. It's so bizarre because like how long has he been dating Cameron Diaz?
Right. A couple months, it sounds like, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a big ass wedding that she's having. I mean, I worked for Modern Bride magazine, so I know my weddings. Like I'm looking around and I'm taking tally of everything. Like the number of balloons alone and that one dumb balloon scene, I was like, it's excessive and expensive. Like you've got to be kidding me. It's astonishing.
They couldn't have even planned the wedding in the amount of time that they've been dating.
No.
Right. Yeah.
No. And like all those people that showed up, I mean, her father is a billionaire. Cameron Diaz's father is a billionaire. And so he can afford obviously to do this, but no one expresses any kind of concern. Like, isn't she kind of young to just run off and get married to somebody? And maybe, I don't know, finish two more years at college and get a degree.
Right.
You know, and something she enjoys, she seemed to have a passion for, but maybe not. And then here's my thing, Patrick. How come she doesn't have any friends?
Somebody hurt her pelvis line dancing.
That's it.
Yeah.
She's in college. She's beautiful. Right. She's an extrovert, right?
Oh, yeah.
She's super friendly, sweet. She would have a million friends.
You're absolutely right. You know, honestly, that did not even occur to me.
I'm a woman. This is why you need me on your show. She would be beating him away with a stick with having friends. I mean, it's just like, I was like, are you kidding me? And so then we have to have Jewel. And then, okay, let me tell you, they had Cameron Diaz in all these like 60s looking retro outfits, like Carol Brady looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Julia Roberts was in like these mannish suits,
right?
You know?
Like oversized suits,
poorly fitting. I mean, God, the '90s were bad, but she looks by the way, Julia Roberts is such a star. She's wearing ugly outfits, and she still looks great in a way. You know what I mean? She just sparkles through. Her charisma is off the charts.
She does look great. Yeah,
she looks great.
And I mean, she's lit and shot beautifully, because I will say one of the things that I like about this movie still is it's rare for a romantic comedy to give a shit at all about what it looks like. And P.J. Hogan definitely cared about the way that the movie looked. And so it's a very well photographed movie, which goes a long way towards making Julia Roberts look. I mean, obviously she's going to look great no matter what, but it's even more flattering because it is a really well shot movie. Didn't like Laszlo Kovacs shoot it or something?
It is
one of the best Chicago. Yeah, Laszlo Kovacs shot it. It is like one of the best Chicago movies, honestly. And I feel like it doesn't get credit for that because everyone's always like Blues Brothers, Untouchables. But man, My Best Friend's Wedding really makes the city look great. And
it looks amazing.
But it's also full of shit because like the amount of stuff they do in a day, I'm like, yeah, no, that's not not that Chicago is like that big of a city, but they get around to places really, really fast that you can't actually get around to.
I can't watch New York City movies sometimes just for that very reason.
Right.
You know, you were doing two subway stops and now you're in Brooklyn. I don't think so. But anyway, so going back to PJ Hogan, he directed Muriel's Wedding before this. Now, did you ever talk about Muriel's Wedding on your show? Maybe we should do that someday.
Sure. We never have. No.
Yeah, we should someday, because it's also the same thing. Like on the one hand, it's really sparkly and fun. And on the other hand, it's really depressing and crazy. Like he has like these mixture of things that happen. Like there's this, you have this one beat going and then all of a sudden it just veers in a weird direction. And he kind of does that here too. Like it's kind of the silly romantic comedy, like very, you know, Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell kind of snappy talk. And then it gets really modern out of nowhere. And then it's kind of the mood goes all over the place for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's one of those things where I feel like Big, not to bring it back to Big, but it's one of these movies that presents some pretty fucked up situations or in this case behavior, and just presents it as like, well, you know how people are. This is just wacky life. And it's not. I mean, I think about the scene, not to jump ahead too much, but, you know, near the end of the film, she finally admits, here's what I did. I sent the email. I just drove away your, you know, fiance. She ran away because she saw me kiss you. I may have destroyed your chances at marrying her. And 2 seconds later, he's like, I can't stay mad at you because you love me.
I know.
It's bananas because, again, we're just supposed to be like, oh, that wacky Julia Roberts. She'll try anything to get her man. But what she's doing is toxic and insane.
She did that whole scene with the email is just so evil and fucked up what she's doing.
Yes.
That just the whole, I remember from watching the movie the first time, like, this is like what a bad, bad person would do is what she's doing right now. And how much did you love that? Like, she writes the email and then it's like save for later.
Right.
Like
one little option. The way that you always do, and she has to think that out loud, and then we get the line like, oh, I have a bunch of saved emails. Send those out for me. No one does. But again, this was 97, and I don't even think I knew what email was. I was like, I'll take your word for it, movie. I don't have email.
I had email at the time. I was working at the time, and like nobody did that. You sent your emails like anybody does.
Why would you save five and then have your secretary send them?
I don't know. It's so crazy because he has this job. Michael has the job. Is that his name? Michael. Yeah. Michael O'Neill. Yeah. He has the job where he's going to be this baseball writer. And, you know, you're going to go on the road to like Pig Knuckles, Arkansas or wherever else, you know, people say, you know, Podunk, whatever. And you're going to be on the road all the time. And she's kind of trying to get him, the father, to give him a public relations job. So he'll stay in Chicago. And he obviously doesn't want to do that. But she's just sabotaging, like she's sabotaging his career. By doing this, and she doesn't care, like just to get him. It's kind of weird.
It's bananas because here's the problem that I almost couldn't get over this time. And maybe I'm not being fair because again, I think Julia Roberts is so good in this movie that she almost sells me on the idea that she actually loves this guy.
Right.
But it really does just feel like she doesn't want someone else to have something that she doesn't even want. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's not until she finds out that he's going to be with someone else that she's like, wait, I love him. But I don't feel like there's any evidence that she did or does love him. It seems like just competitiveness. And again, I will say Julia Roberts, in some of the scenes where she's trying not to cry or they're dancing on the ferry or whatever, like she's so good that she almost sells me on the idea that she's actually in love with this guy. But I really feel like it just feels it comes across like competition for her.
Well, part of the problem is Michael is awful. Michael is a garbage person.
This is another issue with the movie. Why not have them fight over someone who's maybe This is going to sound horrible coming out of my mouth, but like if Cameron Diaz and Julia Roberts are going to fight over the same man, he needs to be a man worth fighting for.
He's got to be a Brad Pitt, George Clooney type.
Not a sentient block of wood, which is what Dermot Mulroney is in this movie.
I like him normally, but he's badly cast in this film.
Yes.
He's basically like charisma free.
Yes.
He just growls and snarls a lot. And like I said, he gives mixed messages all the time. Like he's slow dancing with her on the boat when he's going to get married in a day or two.
And singing, because there's so much goddamn singing in this
movie.
Oh,
the singing in this.
It's like PJ Hogan wanted to make a musical and the studio said you can't. So he just kind of did anyway, because everyone is singing in this fucking movie.
And they sing in tune. And they know all the words,
right?
You know that. Ugh, that one scene. Okay, we have to go back to. She brings in her gay best friend George, who's also, I guess, her boss, right? He's her editor,
right?
And I really like Rupert Everett in this movie, by the way. I think he does a great job with a thankless task.
He absolutely does. This was like, he kind of was the guy who popped off. Aside from Julia Roberts kind of making her comeback, Rupert Everett was the guy that everybody walked away saying, like, who was that guy? Let's put him in stuff. This was kind of like a star making role for him, and it didn't last. Like his career didn't quite take off.
Sadly, no.
I blame that Madonna movie that he made.
Oh, that was the worst movie ever.
Okay, good. Because I haven't seen it since it played in the theater. And I remember when I saw it thinking, this is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And I was thinking about it today, and I'm like, well, maybe I just was overreacting. Maybe I'm being dramatic.
No, I watch it now
and it's fine. But I'm happy to hear that it's really that bad.
No, it's horrible. It's horrible. But it's if he shows up and like, this is another thing 20 years later, it's like, why does she have to make up he has to pretend he's straight. He has to play like he's her boyfriend. And that is actually the very funny line. He's coming to town to fuck me, which I actually thought that was funny. I thought
that was a great line. That was a great line.
She delivered it really well. And I kind of like the scene in the car where he's like feeling up her chest and everything like that, just like being hyper masculine,
right,
hetero guy. I thought that was absolutely hilarious. And then they go right into the restaurant and then we have to sing the Dionne Warwick song. And I'm just like,
This was a like kind of a common trope in specifically romantic comedies. I mean, usually it's like a family singing into hairbrushes, and I hate that. Just people singing to like old Motown songs into their hairbrushes. For whatever reason, this scene became like the takeaway scene from this movie, that this was like the classic scene when they all sing that song. It's garbage. I don't know. I mean, I guess in 1997, if you're seeing this movie and you're having fun, there's a sense of community. There's a sense of like joyfulness in that scene. Mm-hmm. I fast forwarded that scene today because I could not handle the douche chills that I was getting.
Everybody does it. The whole goddamn restaurant joins in.
Yes.
That's the thing that gets to me. It's not like he just does a couple of lines and then they let it go. And poor Rachel Griffiths, who's a great actress. What a stupid part she has.
Yes.
The two sisters, but they sing along to it. And you have to tell you, Patrick, I worked at Sony. I was a temp and we all got to see the movie. And then I was there for a couple of weeks helping out that department. There was one woman who loved this movie so much and talked about it all the time, how she loved this movie. And she kept singing that song, but she only saying this, forever and ever I give you my, and then she stopped. And then like an hour later, forever and ever, you know, it's like, shut up. So I hate that song,
rightfully so,
because she did it for days and I couldn't say anything because I was a dumb little temp. So it brought back stuff for me. I'm sorry. I'll process it out. What did you think of the karaoke scene?
Again, it's evidence that Julia Roberts is kind of a monster.
Yes.
But once again, Cameron Diaz is so good. And the move from like, this is my nightmare, I'm close to tears, to I'm going to embrace this being bad and the entire bar being won over by just her kind of cheerfulness. That totally works for me. What doesn't work for me is the moment where Julia Roberts is like, oh, I've got to give it up too. And she smiles and starts clapping. Like, they got to be true to this character. And if she really is willing to put Kimmy on the spot like that and try to make her look like garbage, she's not going to be happy when the entire bar rallies around her. She's not going to be like, oh, Kimmy, I can't stay mad at you. That's the theme of this movie. Right. I can't stay mad at you.
And it's so interesting because, right, she does this really well. Like, she's scared and she's just doing it because everyone's trying to rooting her along. And then she starts smiling and singing and laughing at the same time, and her shoulders kind of shake. And it's such a great performance. Like, she's just so real and raw and likable. And you're just like, you don't want anything bad to happen to Kimmy. I don't want to marry this douchebag, Michael. She could do way better.
Cameron Diaz, for the first few years of her career, I thought was so interesting and was taking such interesting movies and always being good and interesting in them. You know, mm-hmm. she had done a string of like kind of darker movies where she's playing somebody, you know, whether it's kind of the icy kind of ex-girlfriend that she plays in She's the One, or the kind of damaged goods she plays in Feeling Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And then she comes and does My Best Friend's Wedding, which is a complete departure from the kinds of parts she's been playing, and nails it. I just think she's so good in this movie, and it breaks my heart because I just think most of what she does now is not great. I think as soon as she became, I thought she was like much more interesting almost as a character actor, which doesn't make sense because obviously she looks so much like a leading lady and can carry a movie. But as soon as she started doing, you know, What Happens in Vegas and the one where
Charlie's Angels.
But what's the one where the three women all find out they're fucking the same guy?
Ugh, I don't even want to know about that one. It's Leslie. What's her face?
Leslie Mann and the model.
It's
a fucking bananas movie because it is a movie about three female characters. Every scene has two to three women who become, you know, best friends in the course of the movie. It is targeted to presumably a female audience, and yet it still fails the Bechdel test. I was like, how did you even manage to do that? It's something. The Other Man. It's not The Other Man. What the hell is it called? The Other Woman?
Oh, we gotta look it up. But she, did you ever see the one that was like The Box or something?
Oh, yes. I've seen The Box.
That's a great movie.
I like that movie too. So I'm happy to hear that you like it.
Yeah, I really liked it. So she's Shrek. There's Something About Mary.
It's The Other
Gangs
Woman.
Of New York's.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, like, she tries. Oh, Sex Tape is one of the worst.
The Other Women.
Yeah, The Other. Yeah. Oof. But she's
a shitty ones.
She's really, really good in Vanilla Sky also.
Yeah.
I really.
Yeah, she's good in it. It's not a good movie, but she's good in
well,
it.
I have a weird. I kind of like that movie, but I think Cameron Diaz is so good in that movie. And I think she's so good in this movie. And I'm watching it today with this insane mixture of emotions, because in the same scene, I'm like, this movie has it so backwards, where Dermot Mulroney, which I don't know if you meant to do this when we were messaging, you referred to him as Dylan McDermott. And I was like,
oh, I always do that.
But everyone does. So I was like, I didn't know if you were making the joke about the fact that everyone does that or if you really did just slip.
No, because I'm dyslexic. I mix up names all the time.
Saturday Night Live even did a sketch on it. Like, is this Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mulroney? So there's a scene where he gets upset with her. I think maybe when she first pitches the idea of going to work
for her father.
For her father. And he's like, I'm not good enough for you. He throws a fucking tantrum immediately instead of talking about it. And then she immediately is weeping and apologizing. And I'm like, this is so backwards. This is.
No.
But then at the same time, she says, like, we talked about this. I'm the one that reneged. And I'm like, oh, well, that's also fair. So it's like, on the one hand, I'm like, well, this is so backwards. Why is she crying and apologizing to him? But then I'm like, oh, but OK, if they did talk about it, then I don't know. It's like, I don't want her to drop out of school.
No.
To follow this guy, but then I'm also like, but if that's what she wants, then why, who am I to stand in the way? I'm talking about this like it's a real person, by the way. But like,
no, I get you.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
she has agency over herself.
Exactly. And so a part of me is like feeling terrible, like she's being manipulated or played as a dumb 20-year-old who has no clue. Which is what she would be in any other movie. But you're absolutely right. She has agency over herself. And so I have to forgive even the bad decisions.
Well, she's really 25. So we know that. So that's part
of the problem. Well, right. But I mean, just the 20-year-old character.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same way. Like, it's a starter marriage. Kimmy, like, gets a clue in a couple of years. She goes back to college, meets a great guy. They live in what's the fancy neighborhood in Chicago? That's where she is right now with, like, her teenage kids.
Yes. I don't know. this again, you know, the movie, because Dermot Mulroney is like not super compelling, like you said, he's miscast. It needs to be someone special, and because it's not, we get all these characters talking about what an amazing guy he is. Oh my god, he's so amazing. You're so lucky. Right. Oh my gosh, isn't he so amazing? And I mean, there's never really evidence of that. Like, him singing to her and slow dancing is sweet, even though it's the wrong woman. And I guess if you have a ring that's stuck on your finger, he might be able to help you out.
Right, but that's about it.
Other than that, what is funny?
He's not especially smart. I mean, is he interesting? Mm-mm. Not to me.
Not based on the evidence that we get in this movie.
No. And it's, I know. And you're like, these two dynamic women are fighting over him. And Julie is doing it because they made a promise 9 years ago.
Well, it's because she is in love with him.
Of course.
She loves him so much.
Like enough to like ruin his wedding. Right. And steal him from somebody.
And like tank his life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then she's going to follow him around to wherever the baseball games are. I'm like, what about your successful food critic job in New York?
In New York.
Everyone's willing to walk away from their careers for him.
I don't know. I wrote down one of my notes is Michael is a putz. I just think he's just not worth it. And then I also wrote karaoke was created by asshole extroverts. I hate karaoke.
No, I'm not a karaoke guy either.
Ugh, no, it's like my nightmare. So that's another part I really like on the scene. I like the other actors. They're not given that much to do, but he's got some great people like M. Emmett Walsh. I always like him.
Yeah.
Philip Bosco, Susan Sullivan's always good, but Rachel Griffiths in, like I said, a very thankless part, and Christopher Masterson, I guess that's Danny Masterson's brother. They look a lot alike.
It is, and let me tell you about Christopher Masterson in My Best Friend's Wedding. So this is a weird, pointless biographical digression that I don't think in the 6 years of doing this podcast I've ever shared, but you're getting an exclusive. Yeah. When I was I'm going to sound douchey for a second and then I'll back it up and explain. I was called in to read for the Christopher Masterson role in this movie. And what? as I watched it today, I was like, I could have been like hugging Julia Roberts on the Chicago River, or no, they're not on the Chicago River. They're in the ballpark. And I was like devastated because, so here's the deal. So I was a senior in high school, and when I was in high school, I like did plays and stuff. And I thought at that time, like, I wanted to act, you know? And so I had a drama teacher who handed me a piece of paper that was like an open call, basically, going on in Chicago for a movie with Richard Gere. And so my dad, who was sometimes looking for ways to spend time with me because my parents were split up, so he was like, well, I'll drive you into the city and take you to this open call. So I'm in this big, long line. They call us in 10 at a time, you know. We step forward, we say two lines, I think, and we're asked to step back. So I do it, and I get called back. And this happens four or five times. And it's like every time my dad has to, you know, drive me back into the city and sit there with me. And eventually, they give me a full copy of the script. And it's for this movie, Primal Fear. And based on the title, I'm like, this movie's never getting made. And then I read the script and I'm like, this is trash. This is some straight to video piece of shit. This is never happening, right? So I keep getting called back again and again and again. And I don't know exactly how far I made it. I was like put on tape for the director, blah, 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 blah. So the indication that the casting director who was working with me gave me was that it was fewer than 10, let's say, maybe closer to 5, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't get it, obviously. They call me back to read for a different role, like some glorified extra, basically. I didn't get that either. And then I go see the movie, and it's Edward Norton playing the part. And he goes to get an Oscar nomination for the role. And I find out that, like, he had gone to an Ivy League school. He had lied about his age. He had faked a stutter in his audition. And he's an incredible actor. So I don't have any, like, regret or resentment because I was a 17-year-old child who had no business going up against Edward Norton, who got an Oscar nomination for the movie. But again, the movie got made and went on to be a big hit, and people still talk about it because it has, you know, the big crazy twist at the end or whatever. So that happens, and then it's maybe a year or two later, and I get a call from this same casting agent saying, hey, we've got this Julia Roberts movie that's going to be shooting in Chicago, and there's a part in it, and we'd like you to come in. We want to see you for this part. And so I think I went on two calls for that. Obviously, I didn't get it, but it was like the closest I ever got to famous was having a casting director invite me in to read for a part. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, yeah, of course. That's a big deal.
Well, but it's not at all, you know. yeah, I'm impressed. that's my Chris Masterson. And again, even he is like somebody, you know. He was on like Malcolm in the Middle for years, maybe. And his brother's Danny Masterson. So again, like, I don't actually stand a chance against these people. But that was my brush with quasi fame.
Oh, wow. Did you read the whole script for that, too? Or did they just give you the sides for
that? For
My
Best Friend's Wedding, it was just that scene.
Oh, okay. Did you ever like Primal Fear, by the way? Or do you think it's garbage?
No, I don't think it's garbage at all. I think it's you know, like a pot boiler. I think Edward Norton is incredible in it. And I think it's a well-made movie. It's so much better than the version that I saw in my head when I read the script, when I was like, what is this?
It's I love that movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
not perfect by any means, sure. but I love all of their performances, actually. I think everybody's really good in it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time, but that's another Chicago movie, obviously. That's why they were, I think, casting local people. But then they cast someone who wasn't. They cast Edward Norton, who was not local.
I gotcha. Well, that was a good story.
Yeah, you know, whatever. But yes, we were talking about the cast of people. Yes, even Paul Giamatti shows up for one
scene.
Okay.
I wrote there, okay, all the smoking that happens in this movie, what is going on with that?
It's like jarring, smoking, right?
It's very jarring, yeah.
But
I don't
think
in 97 anymore.
Exactly. In 97, I don't think it was, but now it's like Julia Roberts is not smoking? What is happening?
And they're smoking in the hallway. I'm like, you assholes. You can't get outside. I mean, and I love Paul Giamatti, but I was like, okay, here's another thing I wrote down. Julia Roberts' sunglass collection. She had like 5 different kinds of sunglasses that she wore in this movie. Like, did she pack everything to go there? And then one scene, she's wearing 2 of them at once. Like, there's one on top of her head and there's one on her eye. And it was like, I just want to see your face.
Maybe she had time to run to the store during the hundreds of things they were doing each day as part of the 4-day wedding event.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. And she managed to get a dress that fit her perfectly.
Yes.
Like, there's lots of like little things that, yeah, but she just has the 2 girls and her, and that's it for her wedding party, which makes no sense.
But Dermot Mulroney has no one, right?
Well, who's going to be friends with him?
Jules. They're BFFs. And that's part of it's not like I wanted the movie to flash back at all, but I do feel like it's weird because they almost needed a few more minutes when they reunite for us to see like, oh, the chemistry that they have, the connection that they have is something special. And I get why the movie jumps to introducing Cameron Diaz, because it's kind of a laugh moment and it speaks to what the movie is about, which is, you know, this person getting in the way of the thing that I want or whatever. And I love the way Cameron Diaz is introduced, and it's I think we're supposed to laugh and be annoyed at her bubbliness, but to me it comes across as so genuine. She's like the only genuine person in the movie.
She's the only likable person. Her and George are the only likable people in this movie.
Yeah.
Everybody else is either just really bland or they're assholes.
Right, exactly. So I like that, but I do feel like they needed to do something other than just pay lip service to the idea that these two have a really profound connection for us to understand that, like, oh, she has been in denial and she actually has been in love. I think there's a way for us to believe, oh, she really has been in love with this guy for years. She just didn't realize it. But it doesn't come across that way. It just comes across like he's mine and you can't have him.
That's all it is. Yeah, it's very childish. Her impulses and everything. It's just that. This is mine. You can't have it. I don't want it all the time, by the way.
Right, exactly. You
know, he can live in another city doing something else and I don't care and I just live my life. But now I want him. And it's very strange. That whole scene where they're chasing each other. And she kisses him and then Cameron Diaz runs because she sees it, because of course she's upset. And then he's chasing after her and they're all getting into cars. And then she gets into like a taco truck or whatever that is. But she's like, of course, she's in a commercial vehicle. You know, she's going to fall in her belly shirt. That whole thing. I was like, what is going on with this movie?
97
fashion. And so she goes into the bathroom and then instantly it gets very Australian, I think, at certain points, like the beats, like they're just a little over the top.
Yes.
And like when they're in the bathroom and they're like, cat fight. And all
I
the women are
ready. I hate that scene. I hate
it's
the
so
whole
contrived.
Audience. Yes. It feels like some Richard Curtis bullshit. Like I do not. You're absolutely right. It's like Australian. I do not like the audience of people standing around and cheering and who all, again, can't stay mad at Julia Roberts.
No. Like, nobody's there to actually go to the bathroom. They're all just willing to, like, out of a, you know, they're just going to stand around and have this conversation with them. It's so ridiculous. And then what does she do? She realizes they should be together. Very big of you there, Jules. And then she gives them a song. And then it's their song. She goes, you can borrow this until you have your song. I'd be like, fuck you, bitch. This is my wedding.
Right. You tried to break us up this morning.
Several
this
times.
This morning. They were chasing each other around Chicago. And like, we'll find her in the giant city. And I don't even understand why they go to Union Station. And again, it's one of these scenes where there's a moment where I like the way that PJ Hogan kind of frames it. There are some other sequences where he puts Julia Roberts and Cameron Diaz in the same frame. And it's not, I don't know if it's exactly like a split diopter shot, but they're both in focus. And I was like, well, actually, thematically, that's not what it should be, right? They should almost be shifting in and out of focus depending mm-hmm. on the moment. But at the end, when she's sitting across from George, I really like the use of widescreen because they really are at opposite sides of the frame. And we finally get, you know, the appropriate distance between them.
Right.
But he says, like, well, I came here because this is where I proposed. What is the fucking rationale where she sees her fiance, who she's marrying that day, kiss a woman whom she has admitted to being insanely jealous of, and her first thought is, I must run to the place where he proposed. That is where I will find healing.
She doesn't, though, right? She's
not there, but that's where he goes to look for her.
That's where he thinks he's going to find her. Like,
why would he think that that's where she would go?
You're right. That's really stupid. Because she's obviously going to be at the ballpark in the bathroom.
Obviously,
she's going to be sitting on a toilet in a public place.
And Julia Roberts in the enormous city of Chicago at the enormous Comiskey Park easily finds the one bathroom and the one stall where Cameron Diaz is located.
Who's not doing anything at the time. Like, she could just pop out of that stall right away. And,
neither
like,
are any of the other women. So
yeah,
it's
nobody's
fine.
Going to the bathroom. They're just waiting for a cat. Right. Oh my God. That's so stupid. And then they, on all that time, then they have to go back. And like, I'm telling you, I work for Bridal Magazine. It takes hours to do your hair and your makeup and all that stuff. You don't need this bullshit that day. The day of the wedding?
Right, right. Well, it wasn't really like an extravagant wedding, though. So you could tell that they just threw it together.
There was 1,000 balloons in that one scene. I'm telling you, I was obsessed. I'm like,
you would need days to put that wedding together. Just,
you
I don't mean, yeah, I don't even mean like organize it. I mean, literally to set it up.
And they sang the Annie song because they sucked on the balloon and were singing another song, the John Denver song. It's like,
that could have been me. Is what I, that's all I'm saying. That could have been me singing with the helium, harmonizing.
It's so extravagant. Harmonizing. There should be like a wedding planner yelling at people like, hey, you right. get your shit together. Like, there's a makeup person, there's a hair person, there's food being cooked and catered. Like, a lot, you've been married. A lot goes on your wedding day, and
yes.
especially when it's on the level of something like this. And nobody seems to be in charge. Nobody seems to, the parents are never concerned at all. They take off.
Right. Well, and then, you know, just the whole like, let's go change into street clothes and leave for our honeymoon. I don't know, halfway through the wedding. I don't know how this works, but no one seems to be in a hurry to be leaving. So it's just the new couple that is like, all right, peace, we're out of here. But not before he hugs Julia Roberts one more time. He can't stay mad at her.
And originally, by the way, it was going to end that she meets John Corbett. And like he starts to try to pick her up, and you're supposed to be like, oh, okay, she's going to get a boyfriend. She's going to have a real relationship. And the audiences hated it. So they actually brought George back. And so that's why we have that scene.
It feels like a reshoot because it's the same ending as Pretty in Pink, basically, which also had to go through a reshoot at the end. That's a terrible idea, I think. Because, again, I don't think that the movie does the work to suggest that, okay, this experience has at least given her some perspective and made her realize that she's ready for an adult relationship. And part of the reason is because it takes place over 4 days and she can't get that perspective in that amount of time. And even that morning, she's trying to break up a wedding. So I don't think by that night she's like, I'm ready for the possibility of love now. So that is the wrong ending. And it makes sense that, you know, she at least gets to hang out with George and it's like she's going to be okay. She doesn't need a man for that to be the case, right? I mean, not a man romantically. She still has George.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And they're going to be George is in a relationship, right? He has a partner.
It seems like it in that dinner scene.
Because he's just like, they're on, he's talking to her from New York on the, and how much did you love the cell phones? Like the big, gigantic, you know,
it was
thing
so jarring the first time, for the first time she took it. And again, in 97, I thought nothing of it because I didn't really see it. But she takes this giant sat phone out of her purse to call outer space. And yeah, everyone has these giant bricks attached to their ears.
It's hysterical. And so he calls her and he says, look, you know, he's she's running away. He's chasing after. He goes, no one's chasing after you. Like, get a clue, you know, get it together. In that amount of time, he decided she really needs me. So he picked out a suit. He went directly to the airport, got on the first flight to Chicago, managed to find out where this wedding was taking place, who told him where it was, and then showed up just at the same time, like she's ready to like dance on the dance floor or something.
Yeah. That actually sounds about right. Yeah. I like the scene where he says, you know, like he's going to choose her and he's going to marry her because that's what's supposed to happen. Like he's the only one spitting truth at Jules because everyone else seems to be telling her what she wants to hear. So I appreciate that he is, you know, kind of an adult, as is Kimmy. I don't feel like Jules and Michael are really adults. They seem kind of like bratty teenagers a lot of the time.
Yeah, well, they're only 28.
Oh, that's right.
Why would you expect them to act like adults? They're children still.
Well, yeah. she's 27. She's turning 28.
Quite turned 28.
So she does
right.
have a few weeks to find love and get married.
What a bizarre age to put it something. I get 30 because, you know, when you're 20, 30 seems kind of old, right? But 28, like exactly.
And again, when I saw this movie,
you never questioned it.
That seemed a ways off to me. So I was just like, sure, yeah, I guess that makes sense. That's when you would be an adult and I still have some time. Okay, good. Just the notion that like Julia Roberts was 28 and that seemed like she was a grown adult to me. And now it's like, oh, she's a kid.
Right.
They're all kids. Cameron
they
Diaz
all behave
is
like
20.
Kids.
The character is 20, I should say. Why make her 20?
Why can't she have graduated, but it's like, I don't know what I want to do yet. Like, I got this degree, but I'm really not ready to go in that way. Like,
right.
I want to just
relax. Why does it need to be that I need to drop out of school to follow this man around?
I don't get it. And why doesn't she have friends? Patrick, why doesn't she have friends? It makes no sense.
I'm really trying to understand this, because is this the screenwriter thinking that he's, like, writing the dream girl? Because it's messed up.
It's Ron Bass, by the way, who wrote the screenplay. And he wrote Rayman. He has a huge list of credits to his name.
Rayman.
That's the most famous one. Okay.
Rayman.
Have you ever done Rayman?
I've not. It's probably.
I'm not going to. It's a trigger. I can hear it.
Yeah,
it's a trigger
it might
for
not
you.
Be. I would say some things that I regret, I'm sure. he wrote Entrapment. That's a garbage movie.
Yeah, that's pretty terrible.
What Dreams May Come. Wow, he's got quite the resume. You're right.
It's incredible.
Stepmom. There's a garbage Julia Roberts movie where they fucking
I read that
sing
script.
Into hairbrushes.
Yeah, I read that script because I was temping at Sony at the time.
Oh my gosh.
And I was bored one day. So I remember reading that. It's a garbage script, too. Yeah.
I did not like that movie. Wait, he wrote Black Widow. Did you ever see Black Widow?
Is that the one with Deborah Winger?
Yes.
I love that movie.
That's a good movie.
And Teresa, what's her face?
Teresa Russell.
Yeah, she's awesome in that. That's a great movie.
That is a great movie about two women who have more to talk about than just a fucking man.
Do you think there's some sort of attraction there? I don't know.
So I remember seeing this when I saw this in 97. I was like, because I had that friend. I had a friend who I'd been friends with since the sixth grade, and she was like the friend that I had like the crush on all through junior high and all through high school, and was not interested in dating me, you know. So I was like, we need to see my best friend's wedding together, and maybe she'll at least agree to marry me when she hits 28. And I think we did go see it, and I think it just did nothing to sway her because she was never going to date me no matter what. So, but I remember feeling like that I kind of understood the Jules and Michael relationship because I had kind of had something like that, although theirs started as a romance and mine didn't. But now, just so far removed from that, now I'm just looking at it in terms of like, well, what does the movie have to offer? You know, I can't just bring my own experience to this. Like, is it there on the screen, their relationship? And it is not.
No. It's another case of, like we said with Tom Hanks, like we just gave Julia Roberts a situation and then let her roll. You know, it's like the runaway bride. She likes to run away from weddings. Okay. And then we go.
Is that the stupidest idea for a movie ever, by the way?
Is that Gary Marshall, by
the
way?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well.
And again, I'll watch it when it's on TV. Like,
yeah, it's she's very watchable.
She's incredibly watchable when she's in movie star mode. Yeah, like,
yeah, when she's trying to act, not so much for me.
And it's not even—I don't even think she's
in Osage County.
Right. Yeah. See, it's not even that I think she's a bad actor, but like, if Closer comes on, I'm not going to watch Closer just because Julia Roberts is in it. But I'll definitely watch Erin Brockovich. You know.
I like angry Julia Roberts. When she's being angry in a movie, I love it.
Yeah.
I get a feeling like if you pissed her off in real life, like she would cut you, you know? I think like she has a stare, like she could stare you down, you like piss in your pants. Like I think she's got that edge to her. And I think when she smiles and laughs, it is incredibly charming.
It's the greatest special effect in the world. Like it's money in the bank when she smiles.
And you know, it's funny because when she, you know, she did Broadway. A few years ago. No, it was about 10 years ago now, actually. And it was right after she had her twins. And it was Paul Rudd was on stage. And I forget the name of the play, but I had friends who went to see it. And they left before the third act. Like, they just took off. And I was like, what's wrong? Like, she's just not meant for stage.
Yeah.
Like, it just really shrunk her or something. Yeah. Like, it just did not... You know, most people, you know, look, it's not easy for anybody to act on a Broadway stage, for Pete's sakes, but they said it's just not the same. It was so crazy how small she seemed on a stage, whereas in a, you know, on screen, she's like the biggest thing you see.
Yeah.
Like it's hard to notice other people when she's on the screen.
Yeah. Which I wonder if that has anything to do with like them casting Dermot Mulroney. because there's there almost isn't a... There are not many actors, especially one that I'm sure that they could afford, who could conceivably go toe-to-toe and who wouldn't kind of, because this is clearly designed as a starring vehicle for Julia Roberts. And so they don't necessarily want someone pulling too much focus. And so it seems like, okay, well, let's go with someone who's maybe a bit on the dull side, maybe trying to add some gravity to the story, but... It was a miscalculation, I think, because, again, when the movie is presenting us with the context of this guy is so amazing, we need to at least see glimmers of that. And I don't ever feel like I do.
They wanted Edward Burns, actually, at the time. And he didn't want to do the part. He didn't think it was a good part.
It's not.
He would have been kind of an interesting choice.
Maybe, but he's got a little bit of that woodenness, too, you know?
Stiffness, too, you're right.
He works in a certain kind of part. You know, I've seen him in stuff where I've liked him as an actor, but I think we would have been having the same conversation where it's just like, what do these two, specifically these two women, see in this guy?
What about John Cusack? He would have been the right age.
Sure. That I could get on board with. Although, I mean, they would have had to, I think, rework the part a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all America's Sweethearts is a garbage movie, but
it is terrible.
But the scenes with Julia Roberts and John Cusack, I'm all in.
Yeah, they look great together.
I like their scenes, and they have kind of a weird naturalness that the rest of the movie does not have. It's just very frustrating because so many romantic comedies feel like they need this idiotic hook, right? Like,
right.
Like America's Sweethearts or like Runaway Bride. She keeps running away from weddings the way no one does. And even My Best Friend's Wedding, just this idea. Again, I get that they're trying to invert certain romantic comedy tropes and saying like, well, what if it's about, you know, this woman pursuing the relationship that she not only can't have, but shouldn't have. And that's, I guess, interesting, even though it tries to both make her the villain and the lovable hero at the same time, which I think is really difficult to pull off. But it's like my least favorite kind of comedy, which is when they're all chasing each other at the end.
Oh,
like,
right,
I'm
right,
so
right.
much more interested in just these three characters having an honest conversation with each other than wacky pratfalling or driving too fast in traffic or just any of those things that they do for an obvious laugh, or when characters have misunderstandings, things that could easily be explained but aren't. Characters are constantly deceiving one another. Like, none of that stuff for me works in a comedy, because I find it very right. hard to like lose myself and laugh, because I'm just sitting there waiting the entire movie for the other shoe to drop, the scene mm-hmm. that I'm dreading that always comes. And so it's like my least favorite kind of comedy, and this movie has a lot of it.
What is your, do you have like a favorite romantic comedy, or a couple of that, you know, pop up in the top of your head that like,
gosh,
don't do that?
I wish I did. In theory I should, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I love,
can I tell you mine?
Yes, absolutely.
I love The Goodbye Girl, which is like the 70s Neil Simon movie. And it's it's Richard Dreyfuss and Marsha Mason. Have you ever seen it?
I have not.
Oh, what? Okay.
I'm a terrible person.
It's I love anything like 70s New York. I'm kind of obsessed with it. It's a romantic comedy. I love a romantic comedy where I really feel like these two people are falling in love with each other. And they probably should.
Right.
And it'll be fun and cool to kind of go along the ride with them. Like, you, by the time they actually, you know, spoiler, get together at the end, you're like elated because you get it. Like, oh, she likes this about him and he likes that about her. And it's not going to be perfect, but they're going to figure it out. And I just find that so much more interesting. And it's Neil Simon, so it's funny and quick. And it's just to me, like, that's what I love. When you're just telling me, oh, they're supposed to love each other, like, I don't. It doesn't work for me. Like, I like right. to see that, you know, the reasons why. And it's the chemistry. I don't think like she and Dermot Mulroney have really good chemistry.
They don't. And for me, you know, a great way to show couples the falling in love, or that they should fall in love, is when they make each other laugh. And mm-hmm. that happens so rarely in romantic comedies, where two mm-hmm. characters share a genuine moment of kind of making each other laugh. And I don't know, that's such an easy shorthand for me to see that, like, they like each other. They could be falling in love. As we're talking, I'm thinking of a bunch of romantic comedies that I love. So,
go for it. Tell me something.
His Girl Friday would be one.
Yeah, definitely.
The Apartment would be one, although I don't know. I mean, it's technically a romantic comedy, but it's not, like, the most romantic movie.
No, it's got suicide.
Is that not? Spoiler. Is that not romantic? I've been doing this all wrong. When Harry Met Sally is,
of course,
right. I mean,
yeah.
The Sure Thing. Did you ever see The Sure Thing? That's a great one.
Have I ever seen The Sure Thing? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that was a movie.
Have I seen John Cusack movies in the 80s and 90s?
And Daphne Zuniga. When I had mono in high school, I like had The Sure Thing on loan from the library, and I would just watch it and then rewind the tape and then watch it again. Like, it's one of the only movies that I've ever watched on repeat. That's how
it's
much
fantastic.
I love that movie. Yeah.
Nicolette Sheridan is so wicked hot in that movie. Like, she's like the perfect woman to cast in that part.
Well, yeah, because she doesn't have to talk.
Yeah, but you get it. Like, oh yeah, she's really hot. I get it.
I don't know. Even side by side. Ultimately, obviously, he does the right thing. But
of course.
Even side by side with Zuniga, I'm going Zuniga every time.
Well, she's awesome.
Yes, yes. What are some more of yours?
Okay. I love When Harry Met Sally.
Yes.
His Girl Friday is wonderful. Gosh, I'm trying to, I'm not normally attracted to romantic comedies because I find so many of them to be total bullshit.
They are. They're completely phony. And most of them are garbage.
Yeah.
Like, I find them all super watchable. You know, I could easily mm-hmm. watch What Happens in Vegas or whatever, but like, it's a garbage
yeah.
movie.
Yeah, 13 going on 30, I really enjoy.
Yeah, that's fun.
Because that's a fun one. That Jennifer Garner is really sweet in that. I'm trying to think of the other ones. Like, that, as anything with Kate Hudson, I run for the hills. I can't take it. When Matthew McConaughey.
Yes, when Matthew McConaughey was going through that, like, Fool's Gold and Ghosts of Girlfriends Past and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And the most egregious of them all, for me, is Failure to Launch, because there's one that, again, when we talk about stupid romantic comedy premises, Sarah Jessica Parker plays a woman who, as a living, gets men to move out of their parents' house. Like, how
What?
You never saw Failure to Launch?
Oh, fuck no. I heard way too many things about it. I avoided.
Matthew McConaughey's just like an easygoing guy, you know, and he's living with his folks, you know. And Sarah Jessica Parker, they hire her to, like, seduce him and convince him, like, you got to grow up. You got to move out of the house and start your life, which he would be willing to do because this beautiful woman tells him he needs to. And then I guess the idea is that she would then break up with him. But, like, this is her job. This isn't like, oh, we found this girl in a bar willing to do this. This is like, oh, this is a service that she provides. And it's just so insultingly, it's such an idiot screenwriting construct. And so many romantic comedies have that built in, just an idiotic screenwriting construct. And that's what puts me off of so many of them.
You know which one I really love? I just popped into my head. Grumpy Old Men. I love Grumpy Old Men. I love that movie.
I haven't seen it in so long.
Oh, Anne Margaret. They've been playing it a lot lately on Sundance Channel or something crazy like that. They've been playing that.
Oh, that classic Sundance movie, Grumpy Old Men?
I think it's the same time. It's like 95, 96. But it's Anne Margaret and Jack...
Lemon.
Thank you. They're so cute together. And she kind of goes with Walter Matthau for a little bit, but then she comes back to him. It's very sweet.
Wait.
I mean, it's mostly about Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, of course. But they have a great romance in there. And it's just the same thing. Like, you root for them. I want to root for them.
But you're describing something that I can't wrap my head around, which is these are characters who are over the age of 28 and they're not married? I don't understand. How did they get to that point and still find love?
It's a rare thing. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, well, they were all widows and widowers, so that's part of it.
Oh, good. As long as there's a tragic death in the past, I can get on board with their romance.
It's very cute. And then Daryl Hannah's in there and
Kevin Pollak, right?
Yeah. They have a little fling in there too. It's cute. You should see it. It's a really cute movie.
I saw that and the sequel, but I could not tell you one thing about either movie. I think
Meredith.
Sophia Loren pops up in the sequel, maybe?
She's in the sequel, and Burgess Meredith. I don't know if he's in both of them. He's in the first one. He's freaking hilarious in the first one. He's just, you know, he's a grumpy old man. He's just foul and vulgar, and it's a cute movie.
All right. Anything else about My Best Friend's Wedding that you feel like we need to address?
We need to address, it was egregious, the amount of songs that are in this thing. What's with all the goddamn singing? It just was, it was a little too much. It was a little much with, like, the 60s retro, like we see throughout it, that I just, it was a little jarring to me. And thankfully we've matured. We don't have to have a gay best friend that has to solve everybody's problems and that's all they do.
I will say, though, again, one of the things that was kicking around in my head in terms of comparing it to Chasing Amy, and part of it is just like Chasing Amy will have one really smart, true, honest thing, and then like two things that you're like, well, no. And that's kind of how I felt watching this, when it, especially as it came to the Cameron Diaz stuff, where it's like, in some ways it's really progressive that they're just saying, like, she knows what she wants, and yes, she's making sacrifices to do it, but although later on they say that, no, she does want to stay and finish her career, and she does want him to work for her dad, even after that scene where she cries and apologizes, so it keeps selling her out. Was that both of these were, you know, fairly mainstream movies. Chasing Amy was more of an independent, not as independent as Grumpy Old Men, but still kind of an indie, and... both have prominent gay characters, which in 1997 was somewhat progressive.
It was a big deal. I mean, it was around that time that Ellen came out. And
right.
Like, I think it was in 98 when George Michael finally came out, which we already knew. But he finally, you know, it was still considered controversial. You know, we were just still getting used to gay people, you know, hanging out with the rest of us. I don't know, with this new administration, we'll see what happens.
Well, and there was talk, too, of Rupert Everett after he kind of blew up off of this. Like, maybe he could be the next James Bond. And then that was immediate because, you know, he's British and suave and charming and all that stuff. And that's immediately shot down because it's like, well, we can't have a gay James Bond. Like, does anyone give a shit?
No.
But in 97,
Idris Elba,
you know,
wanted to be James Bond.
Right. We can't have a black James Bond.
No. Good God. Yeah, yeah.
We can't have a female Ghostbuster. How are we going to have a black James Bond?
That movie broke my heart.
It was not that great. I was like grappling with the opening number today because I remember really liking it, and I like Ani DiFranco's cover. But I'm like wondering, I'm trying to figure out, how do they choose this song specifically, right? And part of me is like, tell him that you love him and then you will be his. And it's like, okay, I guess that's the theme of the movie, right? Julia Roberts needs to tell the block of wood that she loves him and then she will be Mrs. Block of Wood. But then there's all this stuff that's like, change yourself, you know, like do your hair the way he likes it. And as I'm listening to the lyrics this morning, I'm like, wait a second, this is pissing me off now. What
this
is it?
Is that this is up.
Right. Why are they advocating? And again, because in the context of the movie, Cameron Diaz is like, sure, I'll leave my, you know, career, and sure, I'll drop out of school and I'll be whatever you want. You know, like, it's, she's such a weird character because she's like not a doormat, because we have to, I recognize that, like, we have to give everyone the freedom to make those choices. And yes, we may stand on the outside and say like, oh, but couldn't you still do this? But like, no, if this is what she wants, this is what she wants. But there, it was reminding me just a little bit of the Cameron Diaz character, just like, well, be what he wants, right? That's what they're singing about in the opening number. And so that was like the movie in a nutshell, where I'm like, well, this thing I like, but there's some fucked up messaging in this.
It's also just this fetishizing of like being a 60s girl.
Right.
And that being the ideal, which is passive and very pretty, and you don't have strong opinions, and just, and by the way, we forgot to mention, this is like the whitest movie ever.
Oh yeah.
It's, oh my God.
Yeah. The only person of color we see is in the Comiskey Park bathroom at the end of the movie. Right.
I think there's a couple of black people in the scene that sing in the restaurant. I think
you might be right. And perhaps performing at the wedding. So they're all in like service positions, or are they customers at the restaurant?
Customers, I think. Actual
customers.
Oh, thank
goodness they didn't.
So I think that's there. But yeah, I remember looking like, wow, there's like four white girls. Yeah. Yeah. But at the very top, I think it's three or four white girls all doing, like, really? They couldn't like have a little variety here?
Yeah.
And why? Yeah, you're right. Why that particular song? But they're not all Burt Bacharach songs, right? There's a little bit of a variety going on. But I think somebody said these are all songs sung by Dionne Warwick at some time. I could be totally wrong, but that's what I think I heard.
But like, why is that a thing?
What's the point of that? Yeah, right,
exactly.
Yeah, but what's the point of that?
Right, like,
she was part of the Psychic Friends Network at the time, I think. Like,
why did we decide that? Like, ooh, and we'll do all songs from Dionne Warwick. No one's asking for that.
They haven't yet either. It still haven't.
Supposedly there was a Chinese remake of this movie.
I saw that. Yeah, there's a big market in China now for films. And,
but you haven't seen the remake?
In Chinese, no.
Okay. I haven't either, but I'm kind of curious to track it down, especially because Xu Qi is in it and she's like impossibly great. But I don't know which part she's playing, and if she's playing the Julia Roberts role, I don't know if I could handle it. Like, but again, even the Cameron Diaz part, like, she's very sweet and nice, and like you said, she's an extrovert and she's friendly, and she seems like she's really like fun to be around, but they don't ever like really suggest that she's can carry on a conversation, like that she's really smart. And I'm not saying that they suggest that about Dermot Mulroney, because he kind of just stands there with his mouth open the whole movie. But like, what are those two going to talk about when they're married after being together for a few months?
I don't know what they talked about before. I don't know, like,
how did they fall in love? Oh, right. I'm sorry. He's amazing. Well, see, what you don't understand is he's amazing.
Oh,
he's this great guy.
Yeah, you know, you figure, like, somebody wants to be an architect. Like, that's a tough degree. Like, that's a – you have to be really smart to be an – from what I understand, to be an architect. And it also just – you know, you need a certain amount of love for that, for buildings, for structure, for stuff like that. And, like, she just doesn't seem to have that. Or I don't know what she cares about. Like, she seems like she's just – she's psyched to marry the guy. But what are their lives going to be like?
Right.
And like you said, what are they going to talk about? And are they going to, like, raise kids and go on the road together? Is that – I mean, I guess that's a thing, but is that what she wants?
And again, that's why I kind of fall back on this idea of her being this kind of weird screenwriter fantasy, because she doesn't seem – she seems – the only thing she seems excited about is to, like, be this guy's wife. And that's fine. Like, if you're excited to marry someone because you're in love with them, I'm all for that. But, like, that seems to be her ambition, is to be this guy's wife. And – that to me seems like something that a male screenwriter in 1997 would write.
She did that a lot, though, like with Something About Mary. And there's like a few parts where she is just like the beautiful light blonde, you know, that just like lights up the screen and shows up and is everybody's dream girl. And it's perfect. You know, everything to everybody.
She is definitely in Something About Mary, and Something About Mary almost makes a joke of that.
Right.
But at least it suggests she has girlfriends. She
likes
going to sports. She helps out. She has a career. She helps out with her brother and that community. She has like a life independent of any of the male characters. And so I feel like that movie is actually doing a better job of it than this one is.
Absolutely. No. They but she does a lot with it. She's very winning. She's
absolutely
closing the dark.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Movie made a ton of money, like $300 million.
$200 million.
Was
yeah,
it 200?
Yeah.
I know it made over $100 million in the United States. I thought it was closer to three worldwide.
It could be.
Yeah, it was $300 million worldwide, which is
insane.
Bananas, right? And is still considered like a great romantic comedy. And I just don't know if I couldn't make that proclamation. I think it's one that's a little bit different than a lot of romantic comedies, for better and for worse. I think it's a, you know, a great Cameron Diaz performance, a nice star vehicle for Julia Roberts, because again, moment to moment, she makes it work. It's only when you kind of step back and you add those pieces together where you're like, oh, you're the worst.
Right, right.
But in the moment, you're like, oh, whatever, Julia Roberts, I can't stay mad at you.
I can't stay mad at you. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't know what it is.
Anyway, thank you very much for talking about this movie. It's really fun.
I had a great time. I'm so glad you wanted to do it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah, as soon as you messaged me, I'm like, we need to talk about this. I was like, oh, this is going to be fun.
I was sending you messages.
Right. So, I get excited.
Because I was freaking out.
Yeah.
I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
So everyone, please check out Book Versus Movie, and maybe remind everyone once more where they can find you on like social media and stuff.
Okay, so on social media, you can find Margo and I, we're both named Margo, at Book Versus Movie on Twitter and Facebook. You spell out Book Versus Movie. If you want to send us an email, it's bookversusmoviepodcast@gmail.com. But if you're looking us up and you want to find us in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts, it's bookvs.moviepodcast.
Awesome. Everybody check that out. Remember, on February 11th, we have F This Movie Fest 6 coming up, five movies from 1987, beginning at noon Central Standard Time. We will be watching Princess Bride, Predator, Raising Arizona, RoboCop, and The Monster Squad, and talking about it all on Twitter using the hashtag F This Movie Fest. For more information about it, go to fthismovie.net, and obviously we'll keep talking about it in the weeks leading up to F This Movie Fest, but it is a great time, and I hope everyone can participate. You can find us at fthismovie.net, and we're on Twitter at fthismovie, or you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. You made a sound when I said Princess Bride. Is that because that's one of your favorite romantic comedies?
Oh my God, I forgot to mention that. That is one of my favorites. And then I love Raising Arizona. When you had the lineup for this, I was like freaking out. Like, I'm going to join in totally.
I'm very happy to hear that. That's going to be awesome. Anyway, thank you again, Margo, and thank you all for listening. And we will talk to you guys next week. Thanks, Margo.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.